the power and authority to make binding decisions in both our names. While I take the field against our common enemies in Coruscant, she has assumed the heavy burden of governing both our realms, and I need not tell you that those realms could not be in better hands." He paused again, waiting while what he'd already said sank home. There was nothing new in it, not really. Yet this was the first time he had formally enunciated to Chisholm's Parliament his acceptance of Charlian's full equality as his co-ruler. "At this time, as we face the Group of Four and the mainland realms under its sway across the Anvil and the Gulf of Taro, Her Majesty finds herself confronting not simply political and financial decisions, but the military decisions required to defend our people against our enemies as well. Even now, our forces will have completed their operations against Delpharac in punishment for the Farad massacre, and it will be her responsibility to decide what other actions may be necessary. It is not a task anyone else could conceivably have undertaken, and it is one which I implicitly trust her to discharge successfully, but we must not delude ourselves that she will find it an easy one. My lords and ladies, the dangers which we face, the decisions we must undertake, the prices we must pay are unique." His eyes swept slowly across the seated peers and the members of the House of Commons. "No one else in the history of Safehold has faced the enemy we face. No other realm, no other people, have found themselves at war with the Church, which was meant to be mother to us all. We, the combined people of the kingdoms of Karis and Chisholm, know our enemy. In Karis, we were forced to defend ourselves against a totally unjustified and unjustifiable onslaught ordered by the corrupt men in Zion who have perverted everything Mother Church was ever meant to be. Thousands of my father's subjects, and my father himself, gave their lives stopping that attack, defending their homes and families, and the belief that men and women are meant to worship God, not bow their heads at the feet of four corrupt, venal, arrogant, blasphemous men whose actions profane the vestments they wear and the very air they breathe." He paused again for just a moment, then continued in a softer voice, clear and yet pitched low enough his audience was forced to listen very carefully to hear him. "Oh yes, my lords and ladies, thousands of Carisians died, but so did thousands of Chisholmians. Chisholmians whose only crime was that the Group of Four had ordered Queen Charlian to join her own kingdom's worst enemy in an attack upon a friend who had never harmed Chisholm in any way. She had no choice. They spoke with the authority of God, or so they claimed, and all the coercive authority of the Inquisition and Mother Church. And so she was forced to bend to their will, and how many of your fathers, sons, husbands, and brothers died with my father because she had no choice?" Dead silence reigned in Parliament Hall, and he let it linger. Then, slowly, he drew himself up to his full height. "My lords and ladies, never doubt the courage your queen showed when she accepted my proposal of marriage. It was not a decision she reached lightly, but it was the right decision. It was the decision of a queen who will not see her people's lives sacrificed, thrown away as if they were no more important than deciding which shoes to wear today, at the whim of four corrupt and evil men. The decision of a queen who knew that if the Group of Four's ambition was not checked, if their corruption of Mother Church was not cleansed, the kingdom of Charis would have been but the first of many victims, and the keeper of men's souls would have become the means of their destruction. I know there are those here in Chisholm, as in Charis, who fear the course upon which we have found ourselves forced to sail. Do not think your queen and I don't understand those fears, that we don't share them. To set our own mortal wills, our own mortal hands, against the might and majesty of Mother Church? To set our understanding of God's will against those who wear the orange? To set our defiance against those who grip 8 in 10 of all Safeholdians in the iron fist of their power? Of course we have tasted fear of our own. Of course we came to this moment in trembling, and only because those vile men in Zion left us no choice, and because the other men in Zion did not stop them. Only because we will live and die as men and women who worship God joyously, not as the cringing slaves of a corrupt clique who have set their own power, their own greed, in the place of God's will. Make no mistake, we will never bow the knee to Jasper Clinton and his cronies.
Spines straightened throughout Parliament Hall, and Caleb nodded to them slowly.
That was the reason your queen agreed to become my wife. The reason she agreed to merge our realms into a single greater whole. The reason she, too, has drawn the sword of resistance. This is not Charis's war. It isn't Chisholm's war, or Caleb's war, or Charlian's war. It is everyone's war. It is the war of every child of God, of every man and woman who believes in justice. That is the war your queen had the high courage to join when she might have tried to close her eyes to the truth and avoid that dreadful decision.
Even some of the peers seemed to sit taller in their seats, eyes brighter, but it was in the eyes of the commons that Caleb saw the true fire.
There is not a single soul in Telesburg, or anywhere in the kingdom of Charis, who does not recognize the decision Queen Charlian made, he told those burning eyes quietly. No one who fails to understand the danger she chose to face, with her eyes wide and her head high. And that, my lords and ladies, is why the kingdom of Charis has taken her to its heart. They, as you, have come to know her, and in knowing her, they have come to trust her, to love her. Perhaps the subjects of another realm might question whether or not they have, might be unwilling or unable to believe anyone could win the heart of a strange and new kingdom so quickly. But you already know her, have watched the girl who was forced to take her father's throne untimely grow under the challenges she has faced, seen her grow from the sorrowing child into a queen who is queen indeed, in the full power and majesty of her reign. You know what the people of Charis saw in her, what I see in her, every time I look at her. And because you know her, you know how she could have won her new subjects in Telesburg so quickly.
There was sober agreement and satisfaction in faces throughout Parliament Hall, and nods, and, here and there, smiles of memory and pride as well. Caleb saw them and smiled back at them.
We have not yet been granted the time to complete the arrangements, the reorganization, which was a part of the marriage agreement between Queen Charlian and myself, between Charis and Chisholm. The press of events, the threat of our enemies, has forced us to move more quickly even than we had expected. But those arrangements are too important, too fundamental, to be put aside, and so I charge you, my lords and ladies,
to select from your number those who will represent you in our new imperial parliament. You must choose them within the next month, and you must send them to Telesburg, where they will sit with the men and women chosen by the Parliament of Karis under Empress Charlian's personal direction, and forge that new imperial parliament. I entrust this vital task to your hands, to the hands of Queen Mother Alana and Baron Green Mountain. I do not fear that you will fail me, or Her Majesty, in this essential duty. He saw astonishment in the faces of many members of his audience, and disbelief in not a few of them, as they realized what he was saying. When they grasped the fact that he would allow Charlian to create the new institutions of imperial government without even looking over her shoulder the entire time, that he truly trusted her that much. "For at least the immediate future, my lords and ladies," he told them with a crooked smile, "my own time bids fair to be more occupied with tasks of the sword than with tasks of the council chamber. I wish it were not so, but what I wish cannot change what is. Yet never doubt that whatever Empress Charlian does, whatever decision she makes, it will also be my decision. And if I cannot join her in the council chamber, I can, and will, support her outside it." His voice hardened, turned grim, almost harsh, with the final sentence, and his brown eyes were dark. He turned those eyes on the assembled peers of Chisholm, and no man or woman in Parliament Hall misunderstood his meaning, or his warning. Here and there, one or two of Charlian's nobles sought to meet his eye with defiance. They did not succeed. "A mighty challenge and a daunting task lie before us, my lords and ladies," he said quietly into the intense silence. "And I do not believe God sends great challenges to the unworthy, or that he chooses weaklings for the burdens he lays upon men and women. He expects us to meet those challenges, to straighten our backs under those burdens, and so we shall. We face the sternest test that any have ever faced since the days of the archangels themselves, and we shall be worthy of the challenge he has sent us, of the trust he has shown in us. Here we stand. We can do no other, and we will not retreat or yield. We will prevail, however long the journey, however great the cost, so help us God." 4. City of Chiraeth, Cherry Bay, Kingdom of Chisholm. Caleb Armagh stood once again at the foot of his flagship's gangway. The weather was different today, even colder, but with a heavy overcast and a raw, wet humidity. Baron Green Mountain had assured him there would be snow by nightfall, and a part of him wished rather wistfully that the snowfall would go ahead and begin. It wasn't something anyone saw very often in Telesburg, after all. Unfortunately, he really couldn't stay to watch snowflakes. In fact, he'd spent a 5-day and a half longer here in Chiraeth than his schedule had originally allowed for already. The harbor was less crowded now, since Brian Lock Island had taken the majority of the invasion fleet and the Chisholmian galleys which had been added to its escorts on ahead. Empress of Karis and the rest of her squadron should be able to overtake the lumbering main body without any difficulty. It felt decidedly odd to look out across Cherry Bay's waters and not see Carisian transports lying to their anchors, though, and he couldn't help feeling impatient. The extra delay on his part might not have made any difference at all in the timing of the invasion of Coruscant. In fact, he knew it hadn't, but it didn't feel that way. Not that he could begrudge the extra days here in Charlian's capital. He'd spent most of them conferring with Marak Sandirs, Queen Mother Alana, and their closest allies from Charlian's royal council, and he'd sensed the gradual relaxation of muscles and spines, especially after his address to Parliament. Even those closest to Charlian had nursed inevitable reservations about their new emperor. Caleb could hardly blame them for that. In fact, he was gratified, and more than a little surprised, if he was going to be honest about it, by how quickly they'd managed to get beyond it. Taking the time to accomplish that would have been worthwhile entirely on its own merits, but that wasn't all he'd managed to accomplish with Green Mountain and Alana's assistance. "Of course, not everyone's been so delighted with my visit, have they?" he mused with a certain gleefulness. Despite their outwardly expressed enthusiasm following his appearance in Parliament Hall, his speech had more or less confirmed the Chisomian nobility's worst suspicions. But if they'd been dismayed to discover just how completely their new emperor shared their queen's view of the proper balance between royal or imperial authority and that of the aristocracy, they'd been careful not to show it too openly. The commons, on the other hand, had been downright exuberant, one might almost have said jubilant, at the same confirmation. And much of the uncertainty and even fear many Chisomians had nourished about Caleb's own religious views had been ameliorated, if not totally dismissed, by the masses he had attended in Chiraeth Cathedral at the Queen Mother's side. The hardcore temple loyalists weren't going to care what he did, but his obvious piety had greatly reassured those who'd been concerned by the tales of heresy, apostasy, and Shanwei worship put about by the group of four and their adherents. "How little they know," he thought, rather more harshly, as he looked up at the dark gray clouds riding above the steel-colored winter waters of Cherry Bay. "How little they know." A part of him had found it increasingly difficult to go through the motions of the church's liturgy ever since he'd read St. Journaud's journal. In fact, he often thought, the church propagandists were far closer to the truth than they ever suspected when they accused him of Shanwei worship. If there'd been any of the so-called archangels worthy of reverence, it had been she and the members of the original colony command crew who had stood with her in their defiance of the Archangel Langhorne's megalomania. Which was why Langhorne had murdered all of them, of course. Knowing the entire Church of God awaiting was one huge perversion, a monstrous lie, deliberately calculated to bind an entire planet into an anti-technology mindset, and based upon the murder of any who opposed it from the very beginning, made it difficult to pay even lip service to its doctrines. But Michael was right about that, too, the Emperor reflected. Men can tell all the lies they want about God, but it doesn't change the truth. And the worship of those lied to by the church is no less real, no less sincere, simply because they don't know the truth. And the brethren were right about the impatience of youth, where I'm concerned in at least one respect, he admitted grimly. I really do want to yank away the mask, tell everyone on Safehold the truth. It sickens me not to. Perhaps it did, he reflected now, gazing out across the crowded harbor. Yet, however sickened he might be, he also knew Michael Stainer was also right that they dared not reveal the truth about the Archangel Langhorne's divinity. Not yet. The truth must be told. On that point, the Archbishop of Telisburg and the Brethren of St. Journaud were as grimly determined as Caleb himself. But it could not be told yet. The tyrannical power of the Church of God awaiting must be broken before the lie upon which that power was based could be denounced. Every single human being on the planet of Safehold had been reared in the church, taught since childhood to believe the lie, and they did. To attempt to denounce that lie would only give the Group of Four and Council of Vicars a priceless and almost certainly fatal weapon. The Church of Caris's position in Chisholm was a bit more precarious than its position in Caris itself. That wasn't too surprising, given the fact that Chisholm had no equivalent of the Brethren of St. Journeau. There'd been no one to do the work of preparing the ground the way Stainer and his predecessors among the Brethren had done in Caris. Still, Powell Brainer, who had become the Archbishop of Cerraeth when Charlian made her decision to defy the Group of Four, had not impressed Caleb as much as Michael Stainer. Of course, Stainer was a hard act for anyone to follow, and the fact that Caleb had known him literally for his entire life only made that even more true. Brainer seemed a bit more timid, a bit less willing to confront opposition head-on, and less flexible. Caleb never doubted the man's sincerity, but Archbishop Powell lacked that intensely, almost radiantly caring aura which enveloped anyone who came within 10 paces of Michael Stainer. "Well, of course he lacks it," Caleb scolded himself. "Just how many Michael Stainers do you think there are in a generation, Caleb? Spend your time thanking God for the one you've got, not complaining about the others you didn't get. And don't hold the fact that Brainer isn't up to Michael's weight against him, either." At least, there was no doubt in his mind, or in Merlin's for that matter, that Brainer's espousal of the Church of Caris's doctrines and denunciations of the Group of Four's perversions of the Church were genuine and heartfelt. He might not be another Stainer, but he appeared to have his own dogged, unflinching internal strength. If he never struck the sparks of spontaneous love which Stainer evoked so effortlessly from his own flock, he would be there to the very end, shoulders hunched against the blast, facing any storm that came his way. And that, Caleb told himself, was all that any emperor had a right to ask of any man. There was no telling how someone like Brainer would have responded to St. Journeau's journal, assuming he were ever given the opportunity to read it, which only underscored the strength of Stainer's argument against bringing the truth to Safehold too quickly. No, they had to let the lie stand at least a little longer, until the Church of Caris, at least, had been given time to think untrammeled by the Inquisition's heavy hand. "But the day will come, Langhorn," Caleb promised the ghost of Eric Langhorn in whatever corner of hell it had been banished to. "The day will come. Never doubt it. Merlin and I will see to that." He glanced sideways to where Captain Athrawis stood waiting patiently, those unearthly blue sagean eyes sweeping alertly for any sign of threat, even as his invisible overhead sensors did the same thing, and felt a familiar rush of wonder and confidence. The mind, the thoughts, and the soul behind those sapphire eyes were even older than the lie. Nimue Alban had already deliberately sacrificed her life to defeat it. Caleb Armok had no doubt that the Sagean she had become in death would succeed, however long it took, whatever the cost. Merlin glanced at him, one eyebrow slightly arched, as if he'd felt the pressure of Caleb's eyes. And perhaps he had. Caleb certainly wasn't prepared to set limitations upon the esoteric senses of a Pika. Although, now that the Emperor thought about it, it was more likely Merlin had simply seen him looking through one of those invisible sensors of his. The thought touched his mouth with a fleeting smile, and Merlin smiled back, then returned his attention to the task of keeping Caleb alive. And I should stop wasting time trying to delay the inevitable and get on with my own job, Caleb told himself firmly. It's just that I don't want to. He admitted the truth to himself, then turned to the main reason he didn't want to. Queen Mother Alana had accompanied Baron Green Mountain to the docks to bid her son-in-law farewell. Now, as he looked into her eyes, northern eyes as gray and clear as the Chisholm Sea itself, he saw the same awareness. "I don't want to leave," he told her softly, his voice all but lost in the sound of wind and water and the murmuring sound of the watching crowd. "I know, Your Majesty, Caleb." She smiled at him, those gray eyes misty, and her lips trembled ever so slightly as she smiled at him. "I don't want you to either. But if we could order the world in the way we would have it, none of this would have happened, and you and I would never have met, would we?" "The writ says the world works as God would have it," Caleb replied. "And that much, at least, is true," he reflected. "I think we would have met anyway."
"Perhaps so," Alana said. "Perhaps so."
She reached out to touch his cheek gently, and he saw her eyes looking deep into his own, searching for an echo, a reflection of her daughter. And he saw her expression lighten as she found it, even as he found its twin in her eyes. "Take care of her, my lord," he said, moving his eyes to Green Mountain's watching countenance.
"Of course, Your Majesty."
Green Mountain bowed slightly, then straightened with a crooked, whimsical smile of his own.
"You might say I've had some experience in that direction."
"You have, haven't you?" Caleb returned his smile, then drew a deep breath. "And now I really do have to go. If we miss the tide, we probably won't make our scheduled rendezvous with the main fleet. And if we don't do that, Captain Gerard and Admiral Lock Island will never forgive me."
"Well, we can't have that, can we?" Alana said.
Caleb looked back at her, and she shook her head at him. And then, with absolutely no warning, she threw her arms around him and hugged him tightly. Like her daughter, she was a slender, small-framed woman, while Caleb was a muscular, deep-chested man. That chest still had some filling out to do, but those arms couldn't quite reach all the way around him even now. Yet, if they were slender, those arms, almost frail, still he felt the strength of Chisholm itself in them. His eyes widened in surprise. Then his own arms went about her, and he felt her head resting on his shoulder. A thunderous roar of approval went up from the watching crowd, and Caleb wondered if a single member of the aristocracy would ever believe the embrace was unplanned, unchoreographed. He doubted they would, and he couldn't have cared less.
"My daughter chose well," she told him softly, raising her head and meeting his eyes once more.
Tears glistened, and he eased his embrace enough to use the index finger of his right hand to wipe them away. She smiled again and shook her head.
"I never had a son before," she said.
"Things change," he told her.
"Yes, yes, they do."
Her nostrils flared as she inhaled deeply, and then she released him and stood back once again.
"But we really can't have your captain and your admiral upset with you, can we? Not with a Carizian emperor."
"No, I don't suppose we can."
He touched her face one more time, nodded to Green Mountain, then turned and marched up the gangway to his flagship, through the raw northern cold and the roar of the spectators' approval.
5. Vicar Jaspar Clinton's office, the Temple, City of Zion. Vicar Jaspar Clinton, Grand Inquisitor of the Church of God Awaiting and Father General of the Order of Schuler,
looked up from the paperwork on his desk, eyebrows knitting in anger, as the door to his sumptuous office in the temple was opened abruptly. The upper priest who had opened it so unceremoniously bobbed in a rushed bow, and Clinton's eyes flashed dangerously. Father Donald Farmier had been one of his confidential secretaries for almost 8 years. He knew better than to burst in upon his patron without so much as knocking first.
"What?"
Clinton began thunderously, but the upper priest actually had the temerity, or desperation, to interrupt him.
"I most humbly beg your pardon for intruding so abruptly, Your Grace," Farmier said, speaking so rapidly the words came out almost in a babble. "I would never have done so if it hadn't been... that is, I mean..."
"Oh, spit it out, Donald," Clinton snapped, and the upper priest swallowed hard.
"Your Grace... Vicar Zamson is here."
Clinton's corrugated eyebrows flew up in surprise.
"Here?"
he repeated, his tone as close to incredulous as it ever came.
"In the office?"
"Yes, Your Grace."
Father Donald nodded almost spastically, but there was relief in his voice as well. As if he were astounded he'd gotten his message out without being incinerated on the spot by the thunderbolts of Clinton's well-known temper. The Inquisitor General sat back in his chair, mastering his expression of astonishment while his brain raced. No wonder Farmier seemed so stunned. The Chancellor of the Church of God Awaiting didn't just casually drop in on the Grand Inquisitor without scheduling his appointment well in advance. In fact, no one dropped in on the Grand Inquisitor without an appointment. Clinton spent a handful of seconds trying to think of any reason for Zamson Trenaire to have just suddenly appeared in his office anteroom, but no explanation suggested itself to him. Not, at any rate, any suggestion that he cared to contemplate.
"I assume, since you haven't told me why he's here, that he hasn't told you either,"
he said, in a tone which suggested that that had better be the reason Farmier hadn't already told him, and the upper priest shook his head sharply.
"No, Your Grace."
Farmier's own intense uneasiness at such a radical breach of procedure showed in his eyes, but his voice was coming back under control.
"He just walked in the door and requested a moment of your time."
"He did he?"
Clinton snorted like an irritated boar, then shrugged.
"Well, in that case, I suppose you'd better show the Chancellor in, hadn't you?"
"Yes, Your Grace, at once."
Farmier disappeared like a puff of smoke. He was back a moment later, followed by Zamson Trenaire. The Chancellor's expression had been trained by decades of experience, first as a priest, then as a diplomat, and finally as the true ruler of the Council of Vicars, to say whatever he told it to say. This time, though, there was a glitter in his eyes, a tightness to his mouth. Those who didn't know him well might have missed seeing that, but Clinton did know him, and he felt his own stomach muscles tightening.
"Good morning, Zamson," he said.
"Good morning."
Trenaire's response came out half-snapped, and Clinton looked over the Chancellor's shoulder at Farmier.
"That will be all, Father," he said,
and Farmier vanished with even more alacrity. Whatever curiosity he might feel, and Clinton suspected he felt quite a lot of it, the upper priest didn't want to be anywhere in the vicinity. Obviously, he, too, had read the storm flags flying in Trenaire's expression.
"Of course, only a blind man could have missed seeing them," the Grand Inquisitor thought dryly. "To what do I owe the pleasure?"
he asked, since there seemed little point in indulging in polite nothings.
"To this, Jasper."
Trenaire reached into the breast of his orange cassock and extracted a sheaf of paper.
"And this would be exactly what?"
Clinton's voice was more brusque as his hackles rose in response to the other man's obvious anger. Anger which appeared to be directed at Clinton himself. The Grand Inquisitor wasn't accustomed to confronting anyone with the courage or the stupidity to show open anger with him, and he found that he didn't much care for the experience.
It's a semaphore message, Jaspar. A message from King James in Talkeira. Or rather, from Bishop Executor Frayed for King James. And himself, of course.
Clinton had never heard that particular note out of Zomsen Trenaire. The Chancellor's voice sounded like hammered metal, and the emotion in his eyes burned hotter than ever.
"Obviously something about it has upset you," Clinton said, trying to make his own voice come out more naturally.
He wasn't accustomed to trying to diffuse someone else's anger, but it looked as if Trenaire was whipping himself into an even greater rage with every word he said.
"And presumably, since you've come storming into my office without even warning anyone you were coming, whatever it is that's upset you concerns me, or the Office of Inquisition."
"Oh, yes," Trenaire agreed. "Yes, indeed, Jaspar. I think that would be a very good way to put it."
"Then tell me what it is and let's get on with it," Clinton said flatly.
"All right, Jaspar. I will tell you."
Trenaire dropped the folded sheets of paper onto Clinton's desk.
"King James and Bishop Executor Frayed have sent word that the Carizians have burned half or two-thirds of Farade to the ground. You remember Farade, don't you, Jaspar? The place where all of those Carizians foolishly resisted the Delphiracan troops who attempted to sequester their vessels on your orders?"
Clinton's facial muscles tightened ever so slightly, but he declined to raise to Trenaire's verbal bait, if that was what it was, and simply nodded.
"Well, Caleb and Charlian appear to have decided how they intend to respond to such incidents in the future. They sent 20 or 30 of their galleons into Farade Sound, they pounded the defensive batteries into rubble, then blew them up after they surrendered, and burned every structure within 2 miles of the Farade waterfront."
Anger fumed up in Clinton's own eyes as Trenaire listed the catalogue of Carizian reprisals. He started to open his mouth, but Trenaire cut him off with a quick, sharp wave of his hand.
"I'm not quite done yet, Jaspar."
This time the Chancellor's voice was icy, not fiery hot, and his eyes bored into Clinton's.
"Despite the fact that they burned down most of the city, the Carizians were extremely careful to inflict as few Delphiracan casualties as possible. They even allowed the civilian population of Farade to remove their portable valuables from homes inside the area they intended to burn. Not exactly the response one would have anticipated out of heretics and blasphemers after Delphiracan troops massacred their fellow heretics and blasphemers, wouldn't you say?"
Clinton's jaw muscles clenched, but he said nothing, and Trenaire's nostrils flared.
"I thought it showed remarkable restraint on their part, actually," the Chancellor continued. "Of course, the reason for it was that they fully intended to punish those actually responsible for the deaths. Which is why, Jaspar, Admiral Rockpoint of the Imperial Carizian Navy had 16, Jaspar, consecrated priests of Mother Church hanged."
Clinton's eyes flew wide. Despite Trenaire's obvious anger, despite his realization that the contents of the semaphore message must be shocking, he'd never anticipated that. For several seconds, he could only sit, staring at Trenaire. Then he shook himself and started to shove up out of his chair, his jowly face going dark with fury.
"Those bastards! Those goddamned murderous—"
"I'm not finished yet, Jaspar."
Trenaire's voice cracked like a musket shot, and the white-hot fury in his eyes stunned Clinton. No one looked at the Grand Inquisitor that way. No one.
"What?"
He made himself bite out the single word, and Trenaire's lips twisted.
every one of those priests," he said, and his voice was deadly now, each word precisely uttered, cut off as if with a knife, "was a member of the Order of Shula. In fact, by an odd turn of chance, they were all servants of the Office of Inquisition."
He watched Clinton's expression turning even darker, and there was something almost like satisfaction mixed with the anger in his eyes.
"And the reason they were hanged, Jaspar, the reason that a Carizian admiral executed 16 consecrated priests of Mother Church as if they were common felons, is that the massacre of Carizians in Farad may have been carried out by Delphirakan troops. But it wasn't at Delphirakan orders. It was carried out, as I feel sure you knew very well, under the de facto command of Father Stephen Gravier, Bishop Ernest's intendant, and 15 other members of the Order of Shula."
Clinton had opened his mouth once more. Now he paused, and Trenaire glared at him.
"You lied to us, Jaspar. Lied to all of us."
There was no question in Clinton's mind who the us Trenaire referred to might be. After all of the members of the Group of Four had creatively reconstructed certain events for the rest of the vicarate.
"And what makes you immediately jump to that conclusion?" he demanded, instead of denying the charge outright. "Are you that prepared to take the word of schismatic heretics? It never occurred to you that they might have every motive in the world to lie about what happened and blame it on Mother Church in order to justify their own murderous actions?"
"Of course the possibility occurred to me. Unfortunately, they sent King James certain documentary evidence. I'm sure there were already copies of most of it in your files, Jaspar."
"What do you mean?"
A thin note of caution had crept into Clinton's voice, and Trenaire's lips tightened.
"You know perfectly well what I mean. They captured Gravier's files, Jaspar. The originals of the reports he and his fellow inquisitors sent to you, detailing the role they played. In fact, I was quite astonished at how openly and honestly Gravier admitted in his correspondence with you that the first shot was fired by one of the Delphirakans, not by the Carizians. Or the fact that as soon as the first shot was fired, his hand-picked Shularites immediately took command of the detachments to which they were assigned, and ordered, Jaspar, the massacre of Carizian women and children. My God, man! The idiot boasted about it, and you knew he had, and you never warned us."
"He didn't boast about it," Clinton snapped back.
"Oh, yes, he did," Trenaire retorted. "I've read the reports now, Jaspar. He was proud of what he did."
"Of course he was."
Clinton's eyes flared with contempt.
"They were heretics, Samson. Heretics, you understand? They were God's own enemies, and they deserved exactly what they got."
"Some of them were only 8 years old, Jaspar."
For the first time in Clinton's memory, someone leaned across a desk and shouted at him.
"How in Shanwei's name are you going to convince anyone with a working brain that an 8-year-old child was a heretic? Don't be insane!"
"They were the children of heretics," Clinton grated. "Their parents were responsible for putting them in that position, not me. If you want to blame someone for their blood, blame Caleb and Stainer."
"The Carizians are going to publish these reports, Jaspar. Do you understand what that means? They are going to publish the documents, the very words in which Gravier and his accomplices wrote down, for the record, in their own words, exactly what the Carizians accused them of doing."
Trenaire glared at his colleague.
I can't think of a more effective piece of propaganda we could have handed them if we'd tried.
And I say, let them publish, Clinton snapped back. I've already got confessions out of those bastards, too, some of them.
Oh?
Trinair's eyes were suddenly much colder.
Would those be the confessions Reyno tortured out of the Carizian prisoners you had secretly transferred to Zion without mentioning it to the rest of us?
Clinton twitched, and the Chancellor shook his head, his expression disgusted.
I know you're the Grand Inquisitor, Jaspar. I know you have agents everywhere more than I could possibly have. But don't make the mistake of thinking that I'm stupid, or that I don't have agents of my own. Of course I knew about your orders to Reyno.
Then, if you disagreed with what I was doing, you should have said so at the time.
Even Clinton seemed to realize his retort sounded remarkably lame, and Trinair snorted.
I'm not the Grand Inquisitor, he pointed out. As far as I was concerned, if you could get confessions out of some of them, it might at least have ameliorated the disaster I was already afraid Farade could be turning into. Of course, not even I had any reason to suspect the full magnitude of the catastrophe you and Gravier were busy cooking up for us, did I?
Clinton sat back down, tipped back his chair, and glowered sullenly.
As you say, you aren't the Grand Inquisitor. I am. And the bottom line, Zamsin, is that I'll do whatever God requires of me as his Grand Inquisitor. If that means a few innocents are going to get caught up in bloodshed that was provoked by their own parents, then that's going to happen. And before you tell me anything more about Gravier or the other Inquisitors in Farade, let me point out to you that without the blasphemy, without the schism, being pushed by the goddamned Carizians, none of this would be happening. Forgive me if I seem just a bit more concerned with the future of God's church and the protection of the souls of God's people than with the well-being of a few dozen Carizian heretics or their miserable brats.
For just a moment, Trinair looked as if he were literally about to explode. The Chancellor's entire body seemed to quiver, and a neutral bystander might have been excused for thinking he saw lightning flickering from the ends of his hair. But then, visibly, he fought for calm.
It's just like you to blame every bit of this on the Carizians, Jaspar, he thought icily. It was you and your final solution to the Carizian problem which started all of this. I should never have let you push us all into accepting your proposals.
Yet, even as he thought that, a small voice somewhere deep inside was reminding him that he had let Clinton push, or at least draw, the rest of the group of four into doing things his way. And he'd let Clinton do that because it hadn't seemed important enough to him not to let him do it. Which meant, however much he might try to worm out of admitting it, that the disaster which had resulted was as much his fault as Clinton's.
Of course, unlike Jaspar, I've at least been trying to make things better since then.
Still, he couldn't honestly pretend that at least some of the blood wasn't on his own hands. And however furious he might be with Clinton just now, the fact remained that it could be dangerous, even fatal, to push the Grand Inquisitor and the Order of Schuler too far. Ostensibly, and possibly even actually, Trinair's power and authority as Chancellor was greater than Clinton's. Even the Office of Inquisition was legally bound to accept the direction of the Grand Vicar, after all. And Grand Vicar Eric would direct the Inquisition to do whatever Trinair decided needed to be done. But if it came to an open showdown between him and Clinton, it was far from certain that the Order of Schuler would bother to remember to whom it owed formal obedience.
Listen to me, Jaspar,
he said finally, his voice calmer than it had been since the conversation began.
This entire episode in Farade has the potential to do us enormous damage. It's got to be handled very carefully from this point out.
Like hell it does.
Clinton's native belligerence was rousing as surprise began to ease a bit.
They've murdered priests, Samson. They can call it whatever they want, but the fact is that they've killed men consecrated to the service of God. Yes, it's a pity children were killed in the original confrontation. And yes, servants of the Office of Inquisition were involved. But we're in the midst of a fight for the very survival of Mother Church. This is no time to handle things very carefully. It's a time to counterattack. They don't have any proof of the authenticity of the documents they're claiming to have. Call them on it. Denounce their claims as lies and convict them of murdering priests. Then go ahead and call for jihad. Proclaim holy war and burn out the canker of rebellion and apostasy and heresy in Caris once and for all.
No. Trenaire said the single word softly, but there was nothing at all soft about his flint-hard eyes.
Damn it, what are you waiting for? Clinton demanded. For the fucking Carisians to invade the temple lands?
If it weren't for what just happened in Farade, I'd be a lot more willing to proclaim holy war, Trenaire said bitingly. Unfortunately, we have a little problem just now.
What problem? Clinton half sneered.
The problem that while they may not have proof of the authenticity of the documents in their possession, they do have the documents themselves, don't they? Trust me. When they publish those documents abroad, there are going to be enough people, especially sitting on various thrones scattered around the planet, who recognize the truth when they hear it. My office is the one in charge of Mother Church's diplomacy, Jaspar. Believe me, I know what's going to go through the minds of all those throne-sitters, and we aren't going to like it very much. Because, Jaspar, they'll also recognize what happened to Farade after King James did exactly what we instructed him to do for what it was. They're going to see these hangings as completely justified, whatever we may say, or whatever they may say openly.
So?
So how many Gregor Stonars do you want to create, Jaspar?
Trenaire's question was sharp, and Clinton paused abruptly. Gregor Stonar, Lord Protector of the Republic of Sidarmark, and his predecessors had been the worst nightmare of the Group of Four and their immediate predecessors for years. There was no doubt in Jaspar Clinton's mind that Stonar would gleefully have overthrown the Church of God Awaiting in his own lands if he'd imagined for a moment that he could make the attempt and survive. For his part, Trenaire had never shared Clinton's suspicion that Stonar was actively seeking a pretext to break with Mother Church. His fear had been simply that someday some difference of opinion between Sidarmark and the Church would spill over into open confrontation, whether either side wanted it to or not. But, in its own way, that difference between his own and Clinton's view of Stonar only lent his question even more point.
What do you mean?
Clinton demanded after a moment, and Trenaire smiled sardonically.
Fool yourself if you want to, Jaspar, he thought, but don't expect me to do the same thing. You know exactly what I mean.
Of course, he couldn't actually say that out loud.
What I mean, he said instead, is that we've already seen Narman turn his coat and Charlian actually marry Caleb. From all the reports I've seen, it seems likely Duke Zebediah is going to do exactly the same thing Narman did, and that even Hector would if he thought for a moment Caleb would settle for anything short of his head. Now every other prince and king on the face of the world is going to look at what happened in Farade and realize that in Caleb's place they would have done exactly the same thing.
The hell they would have.
I said they would realize that in Caleb's place they would have done the same thing,
Trinair said.
Although, to be fair, perhaps I should have said that they would have done exactly the same thing if they'd had the courage to. But the main point is this. Given the way Karis is going to present what happened, we don't have a leg to stand on. No! He raised his voice and jabbed the air with an index finger when Clinton tried to interrupt. We don't. Especially not after we've already been telling the entire world what you told the rest of us, that the Carizians started it. Well, they have the proof before them now that the Carizians didn't start it, Jaspar. They're going to be thinking about that if the Church suddenly declares holy war and summons them to battle. You saw what happened when Chisholm was forced to fight a war it didn't believe in. Do you want to see the same thing happen with, say, the Desnarian Empire? Do you want to hand Stonar the pretext he can use, stand upon as a matter of principle, to refuse to answer that summons? And before you tell me you don't trust Stonar not to do that anyway, let me point out to you that whatever the rest of the world may think, our resources aren't actually unlimited. There's a limit to the number of fronts we can afford to fight on simultaneously, Jaspar.
But it's going to come to holy war inevitably in the end, whatever we do, Clinton pointed out. It has to. Unless you actually believe there's some way Caleb might think he could patch things up with Mother Church after murdering her own priests.
In the end is not the same thing as right this minute, Trinair replied, his voice as frosty as the winter snows outside the temple. Of course it's going to come to holy war sooner or later. The only one of us who doesn't already understand that is Robert, and even he has to suspect that no other outcome is possible. And I agree with you that what Rockpoint's done only makes it more inevitable, ultimately. But we not only have to be aware of what other secular rulers may be thinking, Jaspar, we have to be aware of what other members of the Vicarate are thinking.
Clinton started to fire something back, then paused, his eyes narrowing in thought as he recognized what Trinair had actually said. What the Church could survive and what the Group of Four could survive weren't necessarily the same thing after all.
There might be fewer of those other vicars to worry about than you know, Samson,
he said after several moments, his eyes flickering with a slyness Trinair found more than a little disturbing.
Trust me, the number of our critics could find itself rather drastically reduced.
It was Trinair's turn to look thoughtful, eyebrows furrowed. It was obvious he was running through a mental checklist of the Group of Four's present and potential opponents, but then he shook his head.
We can't afford to get too far ahead of ourselves, Jaspar, he said much more calmly. This situation in Farade is going to cause enough problems as it is. If we simultaneously convince the other vicars that we're planning on purging our opponents, then those opponents are far more likely to be able to whip up some sort of opposition bloc on the council. In fact, they'd probably use what happened in Farade as the public basis for their opposition to us.
We can't afford to be too hesitant either, Clinton countered. If those opponents you're talking about decide we're weak, or that we're vacillating, it's only going to embolden them.
Perhaps so.
Trinair's nod acknowledged Clinton's warning, but his expression never wavered.
The problem is that we can't uncouple Farade from someone like the Wilsons, not now that Karis is planning on exploding it all in our faces. We may be able to weather Farade, and we may be able to weather the Wilsons, but the odds of our weathering both of them at once are far worse.
So what would you do? Clinton challenged.
You won't like it.
There was a warning note in Trinair's voice, and Clinton snorted.
And you think I've liked anything else you've had to say this afternoon?
Probably not, Trenair replied. But, as I see it, we have no choice but to take the Carizian's charges against Gravier and the others seriously.
What?
Clinton's jowls darkened furiously.
Jaspar, whether we want to admit it or not, the truth is that what happened in Ferrade is exactly what the Carizians say.